Firstly, it was written on the 8th of Av, Erev Tisha B'Av, and clearly, therefore, he felt it was an urgent question. Secondly is the address. It's the Jewish community of Tehran in Iran. In fact, the last letter he ever wrote was on behalf of these refugees, and he was in considerable pain when he wrote it.
And we've also seen how these matters have been debated and decided by the great halakhic authorities of each generation, as our journey has taken us from the Rambam in the 12th century Egypt through the Maharami Rothenberg of 13th century Germany, via the Mahri Mintz in 15th century Italy, to the Maharam Alshich in the 16th century Sfas, and then to the Sma in the 16th century Poland, and the Knesset HaGdol of 17th century Turkey.
But we never stop to ask ourselves, why didn't he write Truvas? And we know about him as being deeply interested in the educational and moral problems of the community. He was, in fact, an educational reformer, a revolutionary.
Welcome to History for the Curious. I'm Menno Reisner, and I host the internationally renowned lecturer, dynamic historian, and tour guide, Rabbi Aubrey Hirsch. Experience our history, confront dilemmas, and reveal the untold stories of 3,000 years of Jewish heritage, from Paris to Cairo, from the Russian Tsar to Maimonides, and from the Sinai Revelation to the French Revolution. Join the fastest growing Jewish history podcast in the world by subscribing to this channel and discovering the events that have shaped us into who we are today. And welcome back, Rabbi Hirsch. Welcome back to all the listeners. This week's episode is once again sponsored very kindly by Aria Wagner of Starguest. Aria is running his annual Pesach program at the magnificent Kempinski in Engelberg. It's a five-star hotel surrounded by the breathtaking Swiss Alps. And Rabbi Hirsch is going to be the scholar in residence. Please go to starguest.com to book now. Aria does have some last-minute special deals. Anyone who's been can tell you what a fantastic experience it is, and I highly recommend you go check out his website and book while you can. Rabbi Hirsch, we are starting a new two-part series on Tshuvas, responsa in halacha and history, their role and their status. We also have the pleasure and honor of inviting Dayan Hul, who is a Dayan at the Federation and an expert in Kosher Mishpat, to be addressing us a bit later. But as always, Rabbi Hirsch, can you first start with the history of it?
Okay, so at its most basic definition, a tshuva is a response, almost always to a halachic query, and it would have been addressed to one of the leading rabbis of the generation. And the question is, or the questions, are they more important than the halachic compendiums and encyclopedias? Are they always accepted? Is there a sort of pecking order? Does it depend when it was written, why it was written? And perhaps also to understand, why did only certain Rabbonim write them and not others? Now, it all starts in Bavel, the Iraq of today. For five centuries, from the 6th to the 11th, the era mainly of the Goenim, who were located in various towns in Bavel, we know were Pumpadisa, Narador, Sura. Later, this was all moved to Baghdad. But nevertheless, they saw themselves responsible for teaching Torah across the Middle East and the entire Jewish world, which at the time stretched from southern France to Asia. But there was no system to catalogue these answers or to record them, and therefore tens of thousands of them have been lost, but we do still have thousands, for which Cairo is to be thanked. It was the natural distribution point for these responsa to be sent to the Western countries, to Northwest Africa, to Spain and elsewhere, and therefore these answers were often copied in Cairo, a copy kept there, and once again through the Geniza, we were able to, centuries later, discover them.
What do you mean by natural distribution point? Is that because everyone was there or because they ended up there for some reason?
No, it was a distribution point in terms of business. Remember, there is no formal postal system.
It was the easiest way to send.
Correct. Now, a large proportion of the questions dealt with the procedure, customs of tefillah, of the calendar, And during this era, the era of the Goenim, Jewish communities were established in a far wider geographical area than had ever been the case in Jewish history. And therefore now, with the Jews scattered far and wide, different synagogue customs start developing. And the Goenim felt the need to bring order into this situation, order being the word seder, and therefore you find the first siddur is written at this time by Rav Amram Gon. Now, even though that was quite lengthy, generally the responses were brief and direct. In fact, we wish they'd been a little bit more elaborate, because then the addressee and the address would have been preserved. But now what we have is a simplification, often, of a complex law. I'll give one classic example: the status of an apostate Jew, as somebody who'd converted to another religion. Generally quite complicated, and unfortunately at this time quite relevant. So there is a tshuva that puts it quite succinctly as follows. The matter stands thus. With regards to commandments, in other words, whether a person can participate in a minyan, let's say, we judge whether they observe Shabbos or not. But with regards to marriage laws, we judge by birth. This matter is beyond doubt. This is the law, and it's not to be changed.
How do they relate to tshuvas, I mean the Goenim, how do they relate to tshuvas written by contemporaries or even by their predecessors? Do we find in the text that they quoted their predecessors?
Listen, they might. One of the later Goenim, for instance, might refer to something written by a predecessor, but there's no evidence that the Goenim consider themselves bound by previous answers. To the Goenim, their decisions were simply an answer to a particular question. I mean, you know, it's the equivalent of, I guess, getting a Shiloh over the phone nowadays. And most of them were written in Arabic, and this is for 500-600 years. But then everything changes. The language changes to Hebrew, where it remains to this very day. The length of the responsum changes, and the concept of the idea of preserving it, of keeping these, also changes. All three happen almost simultaneously for one very simple reason: the changing status of Talmudic knowledge. Meaning, in the time of the Goenim, knowledge of Talmud was basically confined to Babylonia. But by the 12th century, it was not just the Jews who'd moved across the breadth of Europe, it was Torah. There were yeshivas in Europe, in North Africa, and that meant that the questions were no longer the simple, do I do this? And therefore the answer to a proper legal inquiry takes on a completely different character. The people asking weren't lay leaders, they were rabbonim. You find, for instance, therefore, Rabbeinu Tam, the greatest of the Baalei Tosfos, he gives almost a rabbinic essay to every question. And similarly, the Rashba in Spain a century later, and even in the slightly earlier responsa of the Rif and of the Rambam, when the inquirer was clearly a scholar, the answer was far more elaborate, while other answers, in fact most others, were very brief, and sometimes literally, in the case of the Rambam, it's one word.
I mean, you mentioned the Rashba, for example, in Spain, and you mentioned France. Was there a center for these responses? Was there one address that everyone sent their questions to, or?
No. The geography of responsa writing is anything but uniform. You know, one country will suddenly emerge as a center and fade out, even though its Jewish population might still be large and the, you know, there still might be many Talmudic students in that city. It is sometimes national historical factors that create these tshuvas. So, for instance, it's almost inevitable that after the expulsion from Spain, responsa would exist in the newly formed Spanish Jewish communities. Their first place of resettlement was North Africa, mainly Tunis, Algiers, although, interestingly, this is where the earliest tshuvas written in the times of the Goenim had been written. But here, in the 1500s, you find the native Jews, those in North Africa, differed greatly from the new immigrants. Their learning, both Jewish and secular, in North Africa was inferior to that of the newcomers. Their economic development was less advanced. Many of their religious customs were quite peculiar to themselves. And this created misunderstandings, communal disputes between the native North African Druze, the wearers of the turban, as they were referred to, and the Spanish newcomers. This required an adjustment. And then you have other complicating factors. As the decades followed, many of the Jews who'd remained in Spain had been forcibly converted to Christianity and then escaped. And now there are problems about yichus, about lineage. Many of them had married in church. Was their marriage valid? Obviously, we're talking about between two Jews, both of whom were hidden Jews. What about their children? Do their children need to be in some way converted? And in fact, you could say, more basically, perhaps, the question was, what is the definition of a Jewish community? Is it the entire Jewry of a particular city, or was it just each separate congregation? And this created questions, sometimes acrimonious, of communal organization. And at the same time that this is happening in North Africa, you have a similar problem in Poland. There, the problems were somewhat different, but in a way comparable, meaning Poland was a new, undeveloped country, and there were no pre-existing communities, but the very fact that Jews were now emigrating westward from Germany, from Bohemia, meant that communal life now had to be built and defined. They developed yeshivas. They had to deal with issues of trade with non-Jews, with taxation towards the royalty. And so the rabbis needed to lay down a legal basis for all this. And also in the 1500s, Rav Yosef Cairo, he writes the Beis Yosef, which is a forerunner to his Shulchan Aruch, his Code of Jewish Law, which relied heavily on responsa. In fact, you could say so much so, it made responsa a permanent determining factor in halacha. So you have this very creative period during the 1500s, and then there is a lull. Yes, there's always responsa being written, but there's no great author for almost a century. You could say that the Chavos Yair in Worms is really the next major influence. And then after that, Jewish life remains fairly static for another century. There are very few new major problems. And therefore, that which already existed, the responsa collections of Turkish and Polish rabbis of the 16th and early 17th centuries, contain the answer to most questions. Because basically, responsa are a question where something has not been dealt with. It's a new detail, a new discovery. So that's where it comes from.
Are you talking about the discovery of science or discovery of new countries, new locations?
I would be talking even more mundane, even in the world of food. There are major discussions in the 1700s about the turkey, the bird, about the potato, about various types of fish, biblically kosher or treif. There were meals which had ramifications and waves across Europe. So that's in the 1700s. But then in the beginning of the 19th century, you have the Industrial Revolution. People start moving into the cities. There's a population growth. There are things like machine-made matzahs. There are automated factories working on Shabbos. There are trains running across Europe. There are new modes of business. And there are also new and, unfortunately, closer relationships with the non-Jewish world, and therefore new ideas of quote-unquote worship. And then there is emancipation, which happens in countries across Western and Central Europe, and Jewish rights now become an issue. Yet, even with all that taking place, in places like Russia, these new inventions were basically, you know, they were very slow to penetrate. It was much more the Austro-Hungarian Empire and Germany, so Hungary and Galicia, that was responsible for responding to change and new questions. Whereas the vast learning in Russian-controlled Poland and Lithuania was far more focused on the yeshivas, Mir, Volozhin, which were not geared to halacha lemaisa. They weren't practical questions of communal halacha, but to learn the theory and the foundations. And therefore, you find that many of the Sforim published, you know, under the Russian Tsar as responsa were really an exchange of chidushim rather than truvas.
So effectively, you're saying that there wasn't any major change in those few hundred years, and hence we saw a reduction in tshuvas. But really, I mean, day-to-day life is full of big questions. I mean, even till today, the average, most poskim will tell you there are today huge variety of questions which you could be found in a Mishnah Berurah. And yet, even till today, then Rabbonim and poskim, and I'm sure Dainhu will tell us soon, they're inundated with questions constantly about the interpretation of halacha. I find it odd that just a couple of hundred years ago, that was due to...
There's a very big difference, a very simple difference. And that is, back in the day, the vast majority of Jews did not go to yeshiva. And most people asking questions today are not the sort of top tier rabbonim asking of each other, or the second tier asking of the top tier. It's almost everybody who has a question to be asked, and therefore, as you rightly say, you could find the answer in the Mishnah Berurah. And sometimes the rabbi has to gently point that out, because it's now become the province of the many. That's the major difference.
Right.
Now, with regards to Russia, even though we said that as the 19th century started, there is little change there, everything comes to an end. By the late 1800s, even within Russia, Jewish life had been completely overhauled by changes both internal and external. The government, for instance, interfered with the old type of Jewish education, with the rabbinate. And then, of course, there is the emigration of millions, which beyond anything else created a problem for many wives. The men went on their own first, generally, and their husbands disappear without a trace. They're agunas. So you have poskim like Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, who wrote over 85 Truvas just on this topic of Agunas. You also now have a prolific Sephardi halachic authority, the Ben Ish Chai, the rabbi of Baghdad in the 19th and into the 20th century. And now that communication has vastly improved internationally, he is responding to questions from all over the Sephardi world: Singapore, Bombay, Calcutta. And the interesting thing, as we mentioned at the beginning, it's not so much who wrote them and recorded them, it's who did not write them, which obviously we never think about. We never think about the truvas that weren't written. To give a few examples going through the centuries, probably the outstanding rabbinic or halachic authority of the 14th century was the author of the Tor, the son of the Rosh. His code is the blueprint and the layout for the Shulchan Aruch 200 years later. And it included all the main Rishonim. It wasn't just his conclusions. It was a listing of many opinions, which he then brings to a head. Hardly anyone was more actively involved with the entire scope of Jewish law than the Torah of Yaakov ben Asher. Now, he wasn't the rabbi of a congregation, but he undoubtedly received questions on legal matters, on halacha, many questions. Yet, this great halachic authority left no truvas, whereas his father, the Rosh, Rav Asher ben Yechiel, wrote both on the entire Talmud and many truvas. And even the Tor's brother, Rav Yehuda, left responsa, but none from him, which is quite odd. Move a couple of centuries later, Rav Mordechai Yaffa, the Levush, one of the greatest Jewish authorities of the 16th century. In fact, his halachic work, the Levush, you could say seriously threatened the supremacy of the Shulchan Aruch. Yet, even though his chief interest is writing halacha, and he was the rabbi of a great community of Prague, where many questions must have been asked of him, he leaves no responsa. There's one, in fact, there's one. It's in the collection of the Maram Lublin. The Maral, at the same time, he writes many different types of Sfarim, which we are familiar with: Kabbalah, Machshava, you know, defending Judaism against Christianity. But we never stop to ask ourselves, why didn't he write Truvas? And we know about him as being deeply interested in the educational and moral problems of the community. He was, in fact, an educational reformer, a revolutionary. It's strange, no Truvas. Move on. Rabbi Yehoshua Falk, who wrote the Sma on Shulchan Aruch, and he wrote the Drisha and Prisha on the Torah. So once again, heavily involved in halacha. He is a pupil of the Ramah and of the Marashal, both of whom did write responsa. And he's the head of the yeshiva in Lemberg, in Lvov. He had many talmidim, active in public affairs because he is a leader in the Vad Arba Arotzes, in the Council of Four Lands. So vital problems come up in front of that body all the time. No Truvas. Rav Yosef Cairo, It's true he did have a set of responsa called Avkas Reichel, but they are almost a minor footnote in comparison to the Beis Yosef or even to his commentary on the Rambam, the Kesef Mishnah. How many people know what the Avkas Reichel is? Although one thing we did, so to speak, gain from having the Avkas Reichel, one interesting thing, is his signature, which appears in three works, none of the more famous ones, but one in his responsa. Then you have the two classic commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, the Shach, who does leave responsa, and the Taz, who does not, but he was a communal rabbi in Ostrog. The Vilna Gaon doesn't leave any responsa, although he wrote, you know, incredibly, in almost every area of Torah. It's true, he wasn't a practicing rabbi, but neither was Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who did write Truva. And the Gaon's main Talmud, Reb Chaim of Volozhin, also not a practicing rabbi, did leave responsa. How come he didn't follow his Rebbe's lead on this? And perhaps finally, Rabbi Chil Mechel Epstein, the author of the Aruch HaShulchan, the last of the codes that reworked the Shulchan Aruch, leaves no Truvas. Now, he's a codifier, which means he knows the entire Shulchan Aruch.
When you say leaving Truvas and all the Gedolim you've just mentioned, the ones that did leave Chuvas, what does that mean? Does that mean that they received a question and they kept a copy for themselves and wrote out, or someone wrote it for them? Because generally, a person who would ask a question and receive a response, why would he necessarily keep it? He has his question answered.
So, prior to the 12th century, as we said earlier about, for instance, the Goenim, they wouldn't necessarily have kept anything themselves. But from the time that it becomes halachically important, so from Rabbeinu Tam, the Rashba that we mentioned, we have over 3,000 of his truvas. We'll talk about that more next week. But that means that he understood
the importance of other people needing to take notes.
And of course, the later we get, the further down the centuries we get, the easier it is to collate, both because of printing and because of the ease of communication. So it will also make a difference to what is being preserved. So that will change with time. And in fact, on this point about keeping them or not keeping them, let's go back to the Rambam. The Rambam is obviously absolutely systematic. He wrote his Mishneh Torah as a system, yet never organized a collection of responsa. So there is some reason, some method to this madness. It's not a full system. In other words, I don't think you can create or trace a singular reason or even a series of causes that distinguish two groups, but there are factors that account for some of them.
I mean, even in recent times, Reb Chaim Kanievsky famously received hundreds of letters a day. I don't know if there was someone in charge of noting all of them, writing down.
Yeah, everything. I mean, they're printing them all now. But once again, it goes back to what we said earlier. This is coming from the average individual. This is not necessarily rabbinic correspondence. Now, in general terms, a difference that often exists between those writing a Sefer Halacha or Chidushim on the one hand and those writing responsa is that Truvas go back to the Talmud and they almost try and prove the point from the source rather than the later codes of law. It's very evident in the 20th century Truvas of Ramesha Feinstein. Each responsum is therefore, in a way, an amplification of the Gemara, whereas Halacha is a simplification of Gemara. Now, I am aware that a Pesach like the Tzitz Eliezer or a Bavadia have a different style, but this still is the rule of thumb. And there are obviously different types of influences. Sometimes it's a person's personality. They're more drawn to Gemara than Halacha, even if they are both the community Rav and the Rosh Yeshiva. There are circumstances, time, how settled they were in any one location, and, as we mentioned, how revolutionary their particular generation was, how much it changed. And that's why closer to our days, from the early 20th century, responsa are unavoidable. Life changed so incredibly quickly, you do not find codes anymore. You don't find, you know, systems. There are new inventions. There's electricity, there's technology in war, in peace, there's flight, printing, communication, science, medicine, international trade, relocation. And therefore, there has to be answers to these new questions that occur.
I mean, not all great Jewish communities produce great writers of tshuvas. We have many such examples of communities with big gedolim that were recognized world over, but no tshuvas came out.
Exactly. It's part of this conundrum, and it has to be answered each one independently. Take Vilna until Reb Chaim Oizer, or take Warsaw or Vienna. Where are their tshuvas?
And they generally have no name to them.
Meaning
the Shailas HaTshuvas of the Ramal, the Chasam Sofer, or the Maharam, it's just called that. There's no other name.
Mostly, yes. Much more the case with tshuvas than with Sforim written as halachic commentaries or Gemara. And we'll look at more of that next week, actually. Now, with regards to responsa in general, having seen sort of a general historical introduction to how they develop, I wanted to focus on a specific area of tshuvas, communal financial elements, and particularly repurposing them, many of which had a history behind them. Reb Chaim Oizer, for instance, discusses the case where two cities had suffered from fire and they had collected funds, and now they want to know whether they can send some of it to Yerushalayim, which had a cholera epidemic and was in quarantine. So people, the levels of poverty depended on where you were. And there is a distressing responsa that was written in the summer of 1940, after World War II had already broken out. In August 1939, Russia and Germany had made a pact, as a result of which, when Germany invaded Poland in September, eastern Poland was given over to Russia. Lithuania ended up being semi-independent for the next 6 months, and Reb Chaim Oizer told the yeshivas in Poland to make their way to Lithuania. He was obviously in Vilna, and he undertook financial responsibility for all of them, which was a crippling burden, especially since he was quite ill at the time. Nevertheless, he undertook this responsibility, and he wrote on behalf of the yeshivas to the Western world, which was still free at the time, and especially the United States. In fact, the last letter he ever wrote was on behalf of these refugees, and he was in considerable pain when he wrote it. Nevertheless, he refused to allow anybody else to write for him and that he would simply sign, and he said that maybe by seeing my handwriting, it will increase their efforts. The letter was written to Eliezer Silver, his Talmud, in the USA, and by the time it was received, Reb Chaim Oizer had actually passed away. And Eliezer Silver received it in a state of shock and sadness. So the Orthodox Jewish communities of certain cities in the USA were contacted, but sadly, sometimes by the time the funds were raised, the purpose for which they had been designated was no longer functioning or not reachable. And this was the case in one of the questions sent to Reb Moshe Feinstein, very likely on behalf of the refugees in Lithuania. And Reb Moshe's response was that the clothing that had been collected should be repurposed for a similar charity or organization. And since he had heard that in Eretz Yisrael, they were also in quite some need, it could be sent there. But he dismisses the idea of selling the clothing and distributing the funds because the price of secondhand clothes is minimal in the United States, unlike the countries where the clothing was destined for, where it was absolutely essential. We then have Reb Ovadia Yosef, who is asked, they had collected money for a new Beis HaKnesses because the old one couldn't hold all the people in the neighborhood, and they now want to instead build a new mikveh because the existing one was far away. And there are two interesting items regarding the Truva. Firstly, it was written on the 8th of Av, Erev Tisha B'Av, and clearly, therefore, he felt it was an urgent question. Secondly is the address. It's the Jewish community of Tehran in Iran. Now, it was written in 1972, 7 years before the revolution, but there's no sensing in the letter of imagining the situation 7 years later, and for sure not 47 years later, of the Iran of today. The question is that after 10 years of fundraising, the heads of the community had come to accept that the money is not forthcoming, and therefore they wanted to divert it for the mikveh. Reb Ovadia responds that the Rambam, the Torah, and the Shulchan Aruch agree that money raised for one purpose can only be changed to a need of a higher level of sanctity, based on the Rashba, the Rashbats, whatever. And since the Chofetz Chaim held that a Jew may not live in a city without a mikveh, and that the members of a community can actually force each other to donate to building a mikveh, it can therefore be repurposed, especially since the shul in Tehran, where the problem of lack of space existed, only arose on the Yomim Noraim.
trying to imagine a Tehran where the shuls are overflowing with Jews davening.
Yes.
And it's recent.
Yep, 50 years. Then we have a question asked after the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in World War I. The new Austrian currency, the krona, underwent severe inflation. And Romer Arik was asked about someone who had agreed to pay for the entire wedding expense of an orphan before the currency lost most of its value. Now it's a lot more. And he rules that since the man hadn't pledged a specific number of kronen, he must pay for the entire wedding despite the increase in price. And Rav Yaakov Blau clarifies that if the donation was actually given before the inflation, but the wedding needs were only purchased afterwards at a much higher cost, then the donor is exempt. But if the wedding was held later, the full new amount must be paid. And he also adds that if the wedding did take place beforehand, but the donor only paid much later, he has to pay the current rate, and the orphan gets to keep the difference financially. And therefore, similarly, you know, nowadays, if somebody had promised to buy a set of svarim for a shul, let's say a shas, and the price then suddenly goes up, and the donor has postponed payment, he has to pay the higher price.
So in today's day and age, with such a shaky economy and inflation, it's best to pledge a sum of money, I guess, rather than paying for something to get out of this issue. Keep Diane Hull's schedule clearer.
Right, both sides, right. You then have the Truvas Harosh. In the early 1300s, he discusses cases where tzedakah was raised for causes that turned out to be irrelevant. One case was money was raised to free a captive who'd been kidnapped and taken to a different country, Pidyon Shvuyim. Unfortunately, after the money was raised, it was learned that this captive had converted to Islam and married a Muslim and didn't want to return to Yiddishkeit. The other case he discusses is where money was raised for a funeral of a person who was deathly ill, but miraculously, the man recovered and the money was no longer needed. In both cases, where the entire cause ended up being irrelevant, the Rosh rules that the donations were given in error and should actually be returned to the donors and not repurposed.
So I'm assuming the case we gave before where the money should be used for a higher purpose is probably if the donors can't be traced.
Well, this is where it's a higher level of Kedusha, it's still a communal activity, whereas the case of the Rosh, it's very specific. It's for X, it's for this person, and therefore it doesn't get repurposed. And if the donors can't be traced, then the money should be given to a similar cause of tzedakah. Finally, we have the Tzitz Eliezer, who discusses whether you can repurpose charity that you pledge to a mushulach coming collecting in shul during shacharis. And he says the big question is, how did you pledge, verbally or in your mind? If you didn't say or do anything, you just thought in your mind, I will give this person, or I will give them X, it is not binding, even according to the stringent opinion of the Ramah. However, if you said, I will give charity, but only in your head did you specify an amount and to whom, then the Ramah says you are bound. So equally, if you indicated to the Oni an amount without words, you know, you held up three fingers for £3, or you keyed in that amount on the credit card terminal, then you would be bound according to the Ramah. But there is a leniency here. It often happens, someone's davening a shul, he sees a poor person collecting tzedakah, he takes out £1, $1, and he has in mind to give it to the poor person, but by the time he looks up, the guy's gone. So since he only thought in his mind that he would give the dollar to the poor person, he can now give it to a different collector instead of the same type, e.g., you know, an Oni, a poor person.
Don't want to get too much off the point, but if someone, it's common practice now to put aside an amount of money by, you know, under your talisberg,
yes,
for the mishloach, and that inevitably come around. What if no one comes around?
No, but that's just general. You don't have anything and anybody in mind.
So you could just put it back in if no one comes,
yes,
for the next day.
Because you do not know how much will be spent. It's not a fixed vow. It's not a neder. That's the issue that the Ramah is dealing with.
But we digress.
Well, we will end with an historical snippet regarding tzedakah from Rav Avraham Danzig, the Chaya Odom. He writes that in a town where there is a central system to collect for all the poor people their needs, which is legislated in Shulchan Aruch, no Oni, no poor person can go collecting to demand tzedakah without permission from the gabbai of tzedakah. You can't go around door to door in that case. But he adds, the Oni has the right to ask people to give him money above their normal donation from anyone. And he then adds, and this is what I did. When there was an accusation in Vilna and an outrage, He doesn't specify what happened. And his mechutan told him to go ahead and collect from people in town a voluntary donation. And the mechutan added, you don't have to tell the warden of the town's charity who this money is for. And that's what the Chaya Odom did. Who was his mechutan? The Vilna Gaon.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Hirsch. We're going to be moving on to Diane Huhl now. Just want to wish you a safe trip, and you'll still be back for next week's episode. We have the great pleasure of inviting Rabbi Yonason Huhl to our studio today. Rabbi Huhl is a Dayan at the Federation based in London. Diane Huhl grew up in Kingsbury and has spent many years in Yerushalayim, where he has, for a number of years, sat on the basin of Nesivos Chaim, as well as on Rabbi Nissim Karelitz's basin in Bnei Brak. He's also the author of an ebook called Beth Din Commercial Arbitration. We will put a link in the description below where you can purchase that, and hopefully soon to be published in print for those of us who are not modern enough to have a Kindle. Rabbi Huhl is one of the most foremost experts in Chosha Mishpat in the English-speaking world, and it's a real honor to have you in our studio today. Thank you for taking off your valuable time to come. And we have invited you today to please go through some of the fundamental tshuvas regarding communal matters.
Thank you. A number of years ago, I was contacted by some representatives of a community in another country. They posed the following shaila. In that location, the general security situation had become difficult due to rising crime in the neighborhood. Robberies and theft were becoming prevalent, and people didn't feel safe in their own homes. Some of the members of the community grouped together to organize the hiring of a private security firm to patrol the neighborhood and to provide a visible presence on the streets 24 hours a day. This would minimize crime and would provide a sense of security for the neighborhood. Such an arrangement would be very costly, and the organizers wanted to require every member of the community to contribute towards the running costs of this project. However, some people declared that they were happy with the situation as it was, with a minimal police presence, and they didn't feel the need for increased security. And still others had actually already hired for themselves private security guards, and so they didn't feel the need to contribute to a community-wide presence. So the question that arose was this. Those who didn't want to contribute, were they required by halacha to pay towards the community-organized security protection, even though they claimed that they didn't need this themselves? There is a broader question here, and that is, to what extent are individuals or families in a city or in a community required to contribute towards communal projects and requirements? Historically, the Jewish community in virtually every town, city, and village would run some form of self-government. In many jurisdictions, the Jewish community was granted by the local non-Jewish authorities some form of autonomy to run their own affairs. But even if that wasn't the case, they would independently organize themselves to run the kehillah, the community. There were various institutions that every kehillah would require, such as a shul and a mikveh, without which Jewish life could not exist. Traditionally, the community leaders would raise funds from the residents to provide for these institutions. Every resident was expected to contribute. Thus, the Shulchan Aruch in Chosha Mishpat in Siman Kuf Samach Gimel says, the members of a town can compel one another to build a wall around the city with gates and with bolts, to build a shul, a synagogue, to purchase a Sefer Torah and Nevi'im and Ksuvim, so that anyone from the community will be able to study them at will. Shulchan Aruch goes on to say the same applies to all other requirements of a city, and then says that even a minority can compel the majority to contribute towards these costs. And the source of this ruling in the Shulchan Aruch goes all the way back to the Mishnah in Bava Basra, Daf Zayin Amud Beis. But now, who will decide in each town what was required, what was a necessity, and what was not required? There's a famous response from Rabbi Meir, known as the Maharam Mirottenberg. He was the quintessential 13th century authority from Worms in Germany. And his tshuva, his responsum, is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch and provides the classic precedent for the deciding of these issues. And he says, Kol tzorchi tzibur she'einon yechonin l'hashvos atzmei. Regarding communal issues that are in dispute, what does one do? How does one decide how to go forward? So he says, one gathers together all of those who pay the community tax and all will accept upon themselves to give their honest opinion l'shem shamayim, and then we follow the majority. If the minority refuse to conform to the decision of the majority, they can be compelled to comply with the decision, and if necessary, even the local non-Jewish authorities can be employed to enforce the decisions of the majority of the Kehillah onto the minority. Those who decline to give an opinion are ignored, and we follow the majority of those who do vote. So says the Maharam Mirotenberg, as quoted by the Shulchan Aruch. Now, with regards to questions of halacha, of Jewish law, every town and city had a rov, and the larger ones would have had a beis din as well. But with regard to other communal matters, here we see democracy in action. Every single member of the community would have a vote in how to best use the communal funds. The only enabling requirement was that you would be contributing towards the communal funds via the independent tax that the community would place on all the members. How much tax did each person pay? There are many tshuvas about this topic as well. But generally speaking, the wealthier you were, the more you would be required to contribute towards the communal fund. And as the Shulchan Aruch records in Simkuf Samach Gimel Sif Gimel, that the common practice was that either the community representatives would make an estimate of each person's assets and income and would apportion the tax burden accordingly, or in some jurisdictions, every resident in the Kehillah would be required to make a declaration under oath to the appointed representatives, declaring their assets and their income, and on that basis, the communal Kehillah tax was apportioned.
So in this response of the Maharam Mirotenberg, does he not differentiate at all between what would be considered to be a luxury and a necessity? This is purely a majority vote?
This is exactly the point. The Maharam Mirotenberg is saying that when there's going to be a dispute about what is a necessity and what is a luxury, you need to take a vote and you follow the majority.
So even if something would be considered by the vast majority of the population to be a luxury, I don't know, say paint the exterior security wall green, and for some reason there's a majority, could that be considered to enforce the entire population to do?
That's an interesting point. And as you'll see in a few minutes, not everything is decided by the majority. There are certain rules as to what Kehillah can force the other, all the members of the Kehillah to contribute towards. But the point is that regardless of what class you came from or what level of scholarship, as long as you were a resident in the town and you contributed towards the communal tax, you were allowed and you were indeed encouraged to vote. Ultimately, regardless of how much you contributed towards the community tax, you had a voice and you had an equal vote. But here we come to your question. What about community institutions that some members of the Kehillah have no use for at all? Do they still need to contribute towards that? So Shulchan Aruch records a ruling of the Maharim Mintz, who was the Rav in Padua in the vicinity of Venice in Italy for about 47 years in the 15th century and actually lived to over 100 years old. Maharim Mintz was a prolific writer of Tshuvas of Responso. And he writes that regarding requirements of a city, such as a mikveh or a wedding facility, these are the examples that he gives, everybody is required to contribute towards the costs, even those who have no need for them. And the Shulchan Aruch brings this to halacha. So even the elderly, for example, who would have no further use for a mikveh or indeed a chatna hall, had nonetheless to pay towards these facilities. Conversely, the Shulchan Aruch also rules if there are in town members of a certain trade who require funds to lobby the local authorities regarding their business, then all members of the trade would need to contribute towards this, but the rest of the residents of the town don't need to participate. So there is an apparent contradiction here. Earlier, the Shulchan Aruch rules that all town members must contribute to communal requirements, whether they need them or not. And yet here, Shulchan Aruch rules that those who are unaffected need not contribute. So the Sma is the classic commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, written by Rabbi Shua Volkatz of late 16th century Poland. He provides a resolution to this apparent contradiction. His words are a little ambiguous. Some understand that he means to say that when the Shulchan Aruch requires everyone to contribute, he's talking specifically about religious requirements, such as a mikveh or a chasna hall. Even the elderly who have no longer require either of these facilities are required to contribute to these communal institutions. However, with regard to business affairs, only those who will benefit from the expenditure are required to contribute. That's one way of understanding the Sma'. Others, however, understand the point a little differently. The point is, they say, that every facility which every community requires, irrespective of whether it is a religious requirement, to that everyone must contribute, regardless of whether the individual needs that facility. However, if members of a particular trade or a business need to raise funds for their common good, that's not something that's relevant to the community as a whole, just to a particular group. And therefore, those who have no benefit from this need not contribute to the fundraising. So what are the differences between these two approaches? There'll be a number of differences that result from these two different ways of understanding the SMART, but let's give a contemporary example. Imagine a high-rise residential building, which has a lift, an elevator. So do the ground floor residents need to contribute to the upkeep of the elevator? In the first view, a lift is not a religious requirement, and therefore those who have no use for it need not pay towards it. However, in the second understanding of the SMART, with regard to a high-rise building, there is an inevitable requirement in every such building for there to be an elevator, in which case all residents of the building will be required to contribute to the costs, even those living on the ground floor, regardless of whether they need to use the elevator or not. So the point is, any communal institution which every community will require, regardless of whether it's something Dafka to do with religion, but it's something that every town needs and requires, everyone will be required to contribute towards, even if they don't have any particular use for it.
And the fact that one's family has a use, would that not be make them responsible to pay as well?
Yeah, so generally the way the Kehillah taxes were distributed was per family rather than per individual. So it was per household they would have to pay the tax depending on their income and their assets. And therefore, if your family had a use for it, you would be required to contribute towards it. And there are other applications of these rules as well. Knesset HaGedolah, who is the famous 17th century encyclopedic Turkish authority, Rabbi Chaim Benvenisti, he discusses a case in which, as was common in many kehilas, particularly in Europe, when it came to sukkahs, arba minim are not widely available. Lulavim and esrogim, for example, don't really grow in the climates of Eastern Europe, and therefore they had to import them. They're very expensive and difficult to get hold of. So it was common practice that a kehillah community would purchase one set of arba minim for everybody and they'd pass it around for everybody to use on sukkahs. Now, there was a situation where there was one wealthy man of means who purchased his own private set. And he said, I don't need the kehillah set, and therefore I don't need to contribute towards the costs of the kehillah's arba minim. So Knesset HaGedolah says that whether he has to pay or not would possibly depend on what we've discussed earlier. According to the first reason the Mahari mints, every member of the community must contribute to the purchase of the arba minim, even someone who doesn't need it, because he'd got his own. Nonetheless, it's something which every community is going to have, and therefore you're going to pay for it. But according to the second reason, as agreed to by the Maram al-Sheikh, which is that you only need to contribute if you have some use for it, however infrequent, then one who has no use for the arba minim at all because he's got his own set would not need to contribute at all. Although Knesset HaGedolah himself argues that it could be that even in that view, he would have to contribute because he may actually need to use it, even though he's got his own set, just in case something happens to his own set. Fit and falls off, it becomes possible, something like that. So since he may need to come onto it as well, one could argue that he would have to contribute towards the cost according to everybody.
That caveat opens quite a large ray of heterim, possibly, if you don't actually have usage but may come into using.
Yes, absolutely. Every case will need to be judged on its own merits and to examine closely the situation. But actually, the question of the person who bought his own set of arba minim is different to the previous cases that we've discussed for a separate reason altogether. In the previous cases, we were talking about someone who's a resident of a town, but he has no use for a particular communal facility. In some cases, he wouldn't need to contribute to that upkeep of that facility. But what about someone who does have use for the facility, but then he goes and sorts himself out by arranging his own private one? That's already a different situation. That's a case where someone who was part of the community did need it, but instead of contributing, arranged something for himself. By arranging for himself, does he get out of his obligation? Slightly different. So, for example, Shulchan Aruch in Simukuch Kuf Samuch Zayin, Sif Mem, rules that someone who's a partner with others in the joint business venture can't unilaterally simply pull out of the partnership and leave his partners to deal with any costs or losses that the partnership is suffering. He can't even say, I make my share, ownerless Hefker, I'm out of here and I don't have to contribute to ongoing losses. Once you're in a partnership, you can't just pull out and leave the costs to everybody else. Similarly, there's a Rambam in Hilchos Shechinim, in Perek Hey, Alocha Des Vav. He discusses a case where Jewish people were living on a communal road and the local ruler imposed a joint tax on all residents of the road. And one person decides he'll close off his front door to the road and create an access to his home from the back. And then he wouldn't be a resident of the street and wouldn't have to pay his share of the tax. But the problem was that everyone else would have to share his share of the tax because the tax was fixed for the resident for the whole street. So the Rambam rules that as a resident, you can't simply remove yourself from the communal partnership if that will result in imposing your share of the tax on the other residents. So too, arguably, if a community decides to purchase or construct a facility like a shul or a mikveh, an individual will not be able to simply build his own private facility and then say, since I have no need for this communal facility, I don't need to pay my fair share of it. Once you're part of the community, you can't opt out unilaterally. So let's go back to our original question regarding the community that wants to hire security guards to patrol the area for the benefit of the residents. Some people say they don't need it at all, and they're happy to rely on the local police. Others have arranged private security for themselves. So do we say that security is a communal requirement and all must contribute towards it whether they need it or not? Maybe even those who have arranged their own private security are not able to evade their communal obligations to pay for communal security. Actually, uniquely when it comes to security, it's apparent from the Gemara in Baba Basra and the Shulchan Aruch that this is a different type of arrangement to other communal institutions. Firstly, the Gemara says the costs aren't shared equally. Those who have more money, and thus they have more to gain from having security guards, need to pay more than others. Likewise, those who are nearer to the periphery of a town have more to fear from marauding bandits, and they will need to contribute more towards the costs of having a shemirah, having guards around the city. So the implication is, the one who has no money to steal and he lives in the center of town and has no fear for his life might not need to contribute at all. So it seems that uniquely when regard to security, the halacha doesn't regard it as a communal issue at all. Rather, it's a private issue that affects many, if not most people. But it's not a communal requirement. It's an individual requirement which we all need, and therefore we will have to contribute. In that case, if you have no need for it at all, you wouldn't need to contribute at all, because it's not really a communal cost. At any rate, I hope this brief discussion will give the listeners an outline of the way that Jewish communities used to run their communal affairs. And we've also seen how these matters have been debated and decided by the great halachic authorities of each generation as our journey has taken us from the Rambam in the 12th century Egypt through the Marami Rothenberg of 13th century Germany via the Mahri Mintz in 15th century Italy to the Maram Alshich in the 16th century Sfas and then to the Sma in the 16th century Poland and the Knesset HaGdol of 17th century Turkey. Each authority analysing the previous tshuvas, the previous responsa, and refining and applying the earlier rulings to the specific circumstances that they were individually asked about.
Danhul, thank you so, so much. I certainly found that fascinating. That brings episode one to a close. Please email podcast@jlee.org.uk for any questions on that. And I really appreciate you coming in, and we look forward to episode two.
Thank you.
Have a good night.